Back, folks, to Zoopy, the Auto Telic Mindset Podcast. I'm here with Canadian Olympian Brody Seeger, alpine skier, just recently competed in the, I want to say 2020, but 2021 Winter Olympic Games. So welcome, welcome on board here.
Thanks a lot, Ryan. Yeah, happy to be here.
Brought in at a young age, skiing as a toddler, and kind of made your way through the ranks. So maybe just start off by like saying how you got into the sport and introduced to this specific area of your sport.
Yeah, so skiing for my family was just a hobby thing. Both my parents grew up with a little bit of just recreational skiing in their lives. Both happened to be at Whistler, and that was something that they just wanted to get me and my younger brother into as well. It was just a family thing. So around the time I was born, my parents were also looking to find a condo in Whistler so that we could kind of continue that lifestyle and head up there on the weekends and ski. And in the summertime, it was all about mountain biking. So for sure an active outdoorsy family, but my parents didn't have any background in competitive sport. There's some of my mom's cousins on that side of the family who actually had some experience in ski racing, so that was basically the only connection we had to the sport. But skiing for me just started, you know, as soon as I could stand on skis. Basically my dad would just push me down the very bottom of the Whistler ski out there, so got us started from a super early age. And I just started in the ski school program at Whistler because that's kind of just what you did with your kids, like teaching them to ski, you know? So that was our weekend family thing. I used to beg my parents to check me out of ski school early so I could go rip around the mountain with them. I just liked skiing around with them. And then you get to about, at the time it was like age 8 or 9, I think, where you switch from being in the mountain ski school program to either going into the Whistler Mountain Ski Club, which is all about racing, or I mean, you can go into there's freestyle free ride programs, or you just, you know, just become a recreational skier. And that was kind of the point where it was a bit of a decision, like, do we try this racing thing? I had some instructors who were saying, oh, you know, it's really good for your development as a skier, like it just will make you a better skier in the long run. So, you know, it doesn't matter if you don't know anything about ski racing, or if you don't have ambitions of being an athlete, you should definitely give it a try. And then some of those cousins on my mom's side of the family also said, you know, it's a great sport. It's great for personal development. You guys should definitely put your kids in that program. So that's kind of how it started for me. We didn't really know what we were getting ourselves into. Just joined the Whistler Mountain Ski Club. I was a pretty good little skier already. Like I had a great group of guys in my group at the ski school level, and we used to just shred the whole mountain. We'd love to just hit every cliff we could find. So I think that translated pretty well into ski racing, just the fact that I was a pretty solid skier to begin with. And so I started to, you know, have some decent success fairly quick, like, you know, for a 10-year-old kid. It's not like the level's super high at that point, but and I think that's kind of how I took a liking to it, though, and getting a bit of a taste for speed. And also I think it just, you know, I'm the type of person who likes to be, I don't want to say like needs to be good at something, but like, I don't want to not give my full effort, and I don't want to suck at something. So, you know, when I got into that, and all of a sudden there's goals and there's something to work towards and there's technique to work on and stuff like that, I think that was a big part of what drew me into it as well. And so I just kind of developed a liking for it, and I didn't really know where it could take me at all. I just kind of went from there.
That's cool. It's cool when you have that kind of self-motivation at a young age, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old, when you kind of have that kind of instilled in you. I'm sure it probably came from your parents a little bit there. So like you said, you were competing, you're about 9 or 10. So how does the program work with regards to, okay, you're at that age, you're doing tournaments, but when does it become like you're representing a team, then you get into the national program, and then obviously, above that? What's the next couple steps to make your way
up the rank? At the time when I started in the racing program, you did 2 years of Kinder 1 and then 2 years of Kinder 2, which is now U14 and U16. And really back then there weren't that many races in a season. You know, we had zone races where the clubs from our western coast zone would come, so you always got to, you know, see the other kid. There was already a sense of team. You know, I was with the Whistler team, and there was the Cypress team would show up, and the Grouse Mountain team, and the Mount Washington team from the island. So we already had a bit of a sense of that, and like some pride for our home mountain, I would say. That whole kinder level, I mean, for lack of a better term, doesn't really matter all that much. And once you get to at that stage, when you were 15, turning 16, that was when you went into FIS, which is the International Ski Federation, the international ranking system. And that's kind of like what matters for the rest of your career, right? That's where you start to get into the international points ranking, and you work your way up from club level to provincial level to national team level, you know, hopefully to the World Cup, Olympics, all that stuff. So and that was a funny learning experience, because of course when you're a kid and you're kind of just getting into it, like everything feels so, or at least for me it felt like it mattered so much, like the weight of the world was on these races. And then you know, at 15, I go into FIS, and like everything you did for the last 4 years in the junior level, it doesn't matter at all. But I will mention actually one of the cool things about at that junior level, we had the Whistler Cup. So at the time there was basically two for kids who were not in FIS, for the whole kinder level, there's two sort of big international ski races that were the only chance at that age to really get exposure to a larger event. And one was Topolino in Italy, and Whistler Cup, which was awesome because we had something in North America. You know, this sport is so European centered. So, and that's coming to my home hill as well. So the you know, once a year, the world, all the best junior athletes would come to Whistler, and there'd be, you know, the parade through the Whistler village, and we had to qualify for either BC team or Canada team. And that was, so, you know, from a young age with that, at least I got a little bit of exposure to a larger event like that, and seeing people from around the world come, and that for sure was a huge exposure to that sense of representing Canada.
Awesome. Yeah. And I feel like through athletes, there's always some point in time that gets the adrenaline juices flowing with regards to, you know, representing Canada one day. So that kind of leads into like my next question. And I usually ask my athletes, like, at what point in your career did your mindset change with regards to, okay, I want to be an Olympian athlete, or I'm going to take this sport serious, and I'm going to try to make it a career. So when was that? When did your mind kind of flip to, you know, the kinder stuff to now, you know, making your way up the ranks?
I think that happened somewhat gradually for me, and maybe in a couple steps. The first one was probably going into that like U16 level. You know, I had some, like I said, I had some success early on in racing because I was just a decent skier. And then I remember I think it was in my second year, I was maybe not doing as great. And the province had this, they started a B2B program where they picked the, you know, the best like prospect athletes in the province. And they started taking them to summer camps and doing extra training. And for me at the time, I was like, you know, ski in the summer, like what the hell? No, summer's for mountain biking. Like that just was did not seem like a normal thing. And of course in Europe, when you're like 10 years old, you're doing glacier camps all summer long. Like it's so different over there. But anyway, I remember just not being selected for this B2B program. And it was a bunch of kids that, you know, I was friends with a lot of them. I had beaten a lot of them in the past. So I remember kind of feeling like, oh, that made me feel a little bit down. But I had this coach at the time, going into the sort of U16 level, who was an ex-national team athlete, Jamie Finlayson, and wicked skier. To, you know, we'd rip around and we'd be doing drills and stuff, and he's demonstrating all of them for me, and he's just laying it over on his edges. And I thought, oh man, like, he's just an easy guy to watch and be like, yeah, I want to ski like that. And he was the first one who kind of, in, you know, he sort of put it to me like, okay, what are you going to do now? Like, are you going to work your butt off and get back there? Like, you know, you can beat all these guys. Are you going to take that extra step, or are you just going to fizzle out? Like, what do you want from this? And he was kind of, you know, pushing me towards doing my first summer training camp, which is what I did. We went down to Mount Hood in Oregon for the first time. And it just felt like that was the first moment where I sort of stepped up. I consciously stepped up my commitment to the sport and thought, okay, no, I do want to give this my best effort. I know, you know, I didn't get taken to that B2B camp, but I can beat a lot of those guys. And well, sure enough, what happened is I came back the next season and I started, you know, I was podiuming and winning a lot of the sort of the bigger zone races and like provincials races. And I remember thinking, it was so funny. There were some people that were like, man, who is this guy? Like, he wasn't even B2B. And I was like, I've been here the whole time. Come on. Like, who are you guys, you know? And so that was a huge step for me. That was very validating. And that also gave me a sense of like, okay, this is what you need to do to like take another step up to the next level. But, you know, I wouldn't say it was that early that I started to think, you know, maybe this could be my career. Maybe the Olympics or something like that can be my dream. I think the true belief in those types of goals sort of came more slowly over the next bunch of years as I made, you know, as I went into FIS and then moved on to BC team after my first year of FIS. And I'm really thankful I had a lot of coaches and people along the way that probably believed in those things for me a lot more than I did myself. You know, I think it was just innately not that natural for me to believe in those things, you know, not coming from like a competitive sport family or anything like that. It was, you know, everybody asks you, oh, you know, are you going to be in the Olympics one day? And you say, yeah, sure. Of course. but deeper down, I think it's harder to actually believe those things. And it, for me anyway, that felt like more of a process over my, you know, over my 3 years with the BC team, you know, starting to really believe that I could make the national team level. And then once I'm national team, like, okay, now it still took me a little while to believe I can really make it at the World Cup level. And now all of a sudden those things that I was never really that sure about, like the Olympics and World Championships and competing on the World Cup circuit, are very much in reach. And I think that's an ongoing process for me. That's just the type of athlete I am.
Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, like you said, the belief maybe wasn't there right away, but, and you keep repeating the word process. It's such a process, mm-hmm. especially Olympic athletes, 4 years, you know, like you said, starting back when you're younger. And I always say these people that come into your life, coaches, mentors, you know, they're indirectly imprinting, let's call it wisdom or knowledge in the unconscious mind throughout your process. Like you said, they were kind of talking about it, but you weren't quite at the same page. But when you got to a certain point of belief, well, it was already instilled in you, whether you knew it or not, because these people were kind of guiding you unconsciously, whether you knew it or not. So when the bigger moments came, you know, it's already inside you, whether you know it or not. So it's kind of cool to kind of hear you talk about the earlier years and maybe not knowing what's ahead, but these people slowly grooming you and guiding you to be this athlete you are today. So it's really cool and getting into the mindset stuff.
I think I'm incredibly lucky that I had role models like that along the way. And I don't think anything here happened by chance. And, you know, if there were any coaches out there listening to this, that I think that would be a huge takeaway for them. Like, you never know how much of an impact you actually have on some young kid's experience. Like, a lot of people, it's just kind of a show up job and just like go through the motions type of thing. But you know, if I didn't have that from so many of my coaches along the way, who knows if I would have made it to this level. So like, you really can have a huge impact.
100%. I totally agree with you. So now that you're kind of guided us through the process here of, you know, making the jumps to different levels. I mean, for me, I don't know too much about alpine skiing. So can you talk about more of the Olympic qualifications, how you qualify, and also like what's the difference between like downhill, super G, and then you have like a combined? Can you explain that to me and obviously the people who are going to be listening?
Yeah, so I think this is actually one of the biggest issues with our sport in Canada. It's so complicated, and for like your average viewer, if they're seeing it on TV or something like that, there's so much that you just like don't really maybe understand what's going on in the sport or in that particular race. So yeah, I'd love to share stuff like this, and hopefully it gives people some more insight and a little bit more understanding of what they're seeing if it does come up in front of them. So first of all, there's slalom, GS, which is giant slalom, super G, and downhill. And slalom and GS are classified like the technical events, and super G downhill are the speed events. And for the most part, people are either speed skiers or tech skiers. At least that's the way it's kind of gone over the years. It's become a lot more specialized just because of the level everybody's getting to. And except for there's a little bit of a weird one with GS and super G, because they're a little bit similar. They're similar enough that a lot of guys are able to kind of go back and forth between those. But it's all about the size of the turn. So slalom gates are anywhere between like, I don't know, 7 and 13 meters apart, let's say, and they're just single poles. And there's all sorts of funky combinations they can do with the course set. GS gates, or GS courses, that's where it goes to the paneled gates. And those turns are anywhere from, let's say, 23 to like 30 meters apart. Super G's just a step up from that, more like 45 to 55 meters. And downhill is more or less just going with the flow of the hill. So it's the fastest, you know, speed goes up with each event, and downhill's the fastest. It just, yeah, kind of follows the flow of the hill. You've got pretty big jumps, but super G's, the difference with downhill is that you have up to 3 training days before you actually do the downhill race. So you ski the same course. It's the same as the race format. Like, everybody goes in order, gets one run. Usually they only try to do 2 training runs. There's usually 3 scheduled just in case there's something funky with weather. But apart from downhill, every other event, you get to inspect the course in the morning, and then you got to charge at full gas. So and Super G is an interesting one, because it can be pretty similar speed to downhill, but you only have one shot to inspect the course, you know, figure out where you're going, and then send it full gas. The only other thing is that GS and slalom is combined time of 2 runs. So they do 1 run, reset the course, you get to inspect again, do a second run. Combined is still an event that's usually, it's either, depending on the hill and where they're having it, it's 2 runs combined between either a super G or downhill run and a slalom run. And combined's a bit of a weird one, because it used to be back in the day when so many more athletes did all events, that was like the ultimate challenge, the ultimate event to win, because you could do it all. But it's because of how specialized the everybody's getting, and how specialized all the events are getting, it's kind of been slowly getting phased out, and pretty much only happens now at Olympic Games or World Championships. Because it's just I don't know, to be honest, people just treat it a bit more like a joke, because, like, you know, you get some guy who only does downhill all year, and then he gets tossed in a slalom run. Like, he doesn't stand a chance against guys who ski slalom and can just like get by in downhill. So yeah, people that just don't, it feels like they don't take it quite as seriously these days.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so, but in terms of like qualification for Olympics and stuff like that, I think our sport is actually, it's interesting how differently the athletes view that stuff, because I think your average person thinks that the Olympic cycle and that 4 year cycle is the most important thing to every athlete across the board. And I don't think very many ski racers see it that way, because the World Cup circuit for us is, it feels like every race is just as important as the last, you know? And there's a few downhill races in particular on the tour that are they're the classics. They've been there since the beginning of, you know, since the World Cup started in like the 20s or 30s. And they're extremely prestigious. They're run, you know, we run the same course every year, more or less the exact same course set. So the guys who have been on the tour for a while have a lot of experience on those. And, you know, like Kitzbühel, for example, is like the Super Bowl in Austria. It's that downhill is, for a lot of guys, probably a bigger goal than like winning an Olympic gold.
Oh, wow.
Because if you win that course, that you, like, your name goes down in history. There's €100,000 on the line for winning that. And you're going up against a whole field of guys who have skied that course, you know, who knows how many times, whereas you show up at an Olympic Games and it's in, you know, Beijing, no one's ever seen that hill before. No one's skied on it. Everyone has like 2 days to sort of figure it out and then go. And, you know, don't get me wrong, it's still a huge thing, but it's our sport is just funny that way. There's some other things that feel almost just as important. So, and for, you know, also for our, in terms of our team criteria to just stay on the national team, we have to qualify every season on the World Cup. So you have to be performing in that level consistently. You have to be performing well to also earn anything close to a living. It feels like it has just as much weight sometimes as the Olympics is like the cherry on top sort of thing. Whereas a lot of other people just assume that's like the only thing that matters in our world.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. That's, I love talking with like athletes like you, and they don't know much about the sport and hearing behind the scenes how it all works. So, geez, there is a lot to it.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me, it's funny, I was watching a little bit of a documentary with golf, and kind of what you're saying too, there's certain courses that are nostalgic and not been around for years, and you want to win those events at those courses just because of the history behind it and all that kind of stuff. So it kind of reminds me of that a little bit. That's cool how, yeah, the different competitions, like you said, the Olympics is sometimes a cherry on top. And, you know, I agree with, I like that, because like you said, it's a process to get there, and it's, you reflect more on all the ups and downs to get there. And when it happens, it's like, this is awesome, but more awesome is that journey that got me to this day or this event. Mm-hmm.
And that's the weird thing too, is like, you might have an amazing season the year before an Olympics, and your criteria to make it to the games is actually more heavily based on what happens at the beginning of that Olympic season. You might have had great results the whole winter, and then the following winter you start off, maybe you're struggling through the first, I mean, it's only like 2 months of the season before the Olympics. And let's say you just struggle through that first half of that season, and you miss your criteria. It doesn't matter what you did the whole season before. There's like maybe a couple things, you know, if you had a world championship medal the season before, so something big like that would carries over. But you know, for the most part, like you got to be performing consistently on the World Cup circuit. And there's a lot of guys too who would potentially put a crystal globe, which is the overall the overall championship for each event through a whole season. They would maybe put that above a single event result, because it is so, there's so many variables in our sport, and there's so many guys that on any given day have the opportunity to win or the potential to win, that it's really a big deal to take a crystal globe in our sport, because that means you've been one of the most consistent throughout the whole season.
So, and going off of, you know, consistency, and kind of moving into like goal setting, because I mean, goal setting is huge with regards to, like you say, being consistent. You don't want to have, you know, that dip in your circuit, because the time comes and those points matter, those events matter, and you don't perform. Like you said, it doesn't matter what happened before. So with regards to staying consistent and at that top level, how do you go about your goal setting personally to make sure you're hitting your check marks and staying on track?
Well, we kind of, you know, we make goals every year and kind of go through every level. Like, let's look at some long-term ones and that will include stuff like Olympic Games or, you know, world championships that might be 2 years out. And then step back. Okay. What do you need to realistically do now at the World Cup level to like put yourself in a position to achieve those longer term goals? And a lot of it comes down to a lot of the goals end up based on your World Cup start list ranking. So you've got once you come into FIS, you start getting you start scoring FIS points every race, and that's the international point system. You can use those points to compare yourself to any other skier in the world. But now at the World Cup level, when you finish a race in the top 30, you score World Cup points. So top 30 results are a huge, huge part of goal setting. You need to be at least in the top 30, because each race, the start list, the first 30 guys who start in the race are only based off of World Cup start list points. So it doesn't matter what you've scored points wise in any race leading up to that. You're never going to start in the top 30 until you accumulate enough World Cup points to get into that top 30. So that's a huge part where consistency comes in. Like you need to either have like a huge result, you know, where you go from, you start, I don't know, 40th and you come fifth or something like that, and that might be enough to put you in there. Or you need to be consistently punching into, you know, maybe 15th to 25th sort of thing. So the World Cup, that top 30 on the World Cup start list is fairly protected as well, because you keep all your points from the previous season, and each race you only lose a percentage of those. So it becomes huge that you're always punching in there, because all the guys who are already ranked ahead of you, their points are sort of protected. They're not going away as quickly. So that's where, you know, when we break it down in terms of our goals, and you're looking at the long-term plan, you're like, okay, now, right now I'm starting 37th in downhill, let's say, usually. I need to finish consistently in the points, first of all, to get myself into that top 30. And I need to, let's say I do that all through the season, and then I'm starting in there, I've got a better chance each time. And then next season, when I'm starting with an earlier bib number, I've got a closer shot at some of those top results. And then that moves me even further up the ranking. So then the following year, when we're going into World Champs or Olympics or whatever, I am actually now positioned a lot better to have a potentially big result. So, you know, we look at where do I sort of want to be finishing consistently? I want to be consistently in the top 20, let's say, on a top end result. like spectrum, I think I'm capable on like a really, really good day of being top five. So let's say I get one of those or two of those in the season, like that would be great. And then going forward, like, okay, now where, once I, when I put in the work for that, now I want to start really reaching for some of those higher results. I want to be on the podium and, or taking home a medal, whatever.
And when you're doing these goal settings, is it just you, or you're doing it with your coaches, your teammates, kind of trying to map this out? Cause it seems like there's a lot that goes into it.
Yeah. Our team, we do meetings probably 3-4 times a year where we go over a whole, it's with all the coaches and staff and just one athlete. So the athletes go through all the meetings individually. And we have an entire like performance plan that breaks down all the aspects of skiing, technique, tactics, fitness, mental performance, and goal setting. And we usually review that 3-4 times a year, and sort of score ourselves on all these things and just check in. Okay, does this feel like this is improving? Is this regressing? What do we want to address more? Are we moving on from that focus we had last time? The goal setting part of it usually probably just happens once a year, preseason. But we regularly try to keep up with those reviews now and then to just see how are we tracking. And I think, I know a lot of other teams and that try to do that same thing. And even when I was on like BC team level, that was always the theory. We're going to, go over things like this a bunch of times throughout the year. But this team, and the last couple of years in particular, has been the only one where we've been really diligent with that, I would say. So I think that's something our team does really well, making sure we review those things regularly.
And I think, like, obviously this is high performance, but I think that goes to like just the average person. I think, at the beginning of the year, they have all these goals they want to put down and they want to accomplish, but you start going and then all of a sudden they kind of fizzle out and, they kind of disappear because they're not checking in with themselves. So I think it's so important at a professional level, but also you can bring it right back down to, let's just call it your average day-to-day person, that the value you get from goal setting. And like you said, just checking in, whether it's quarterly, monthly, weekly, however you want to do it, is so important to your overall performance, whether it's in a sport, business, just being a good, healthy person is so important. So it's cool to like talk about it versus someone who's just your average person, let's say.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing that sport teaches you, even if you never really go on to a higher level, and people don't realize that. Like, it translates to any other aspect of your life. I think there would be a lot of people, if you started asking them about like goal setting in their career, and they'd be like, let's not, I got my job, I just work at my job. I don't need to have like goals or something to check in on and progress towards, like, just working. I think that's one of the great parts about sport, is it just kind of instills that in you and helps you translate those things to any other aspect of your life.
Okay, so this is perfect, because I think with goal setting, I think that just kind of sets you up nicely, especially like unconsciously as well, like you said, kind of sets a blueprint for you mentally, like you said, to start the year and just kind of mentally check in. So like I said, it's a great starting point for you mentally. And then what I want to kind of get into is, now we're in our performance, we're skiing, maybe talk me through some of the stuff, how maybe you prepare, how you control your emotions before an event and during an event, so that you're not getting too high, too low, the negative thoughts aren't coming in, you're not getting too excited, so you're not getting overwhelmed. Maybe walk us through your process leading up to an event, and then maybe actually what's going on when you're performing with your mindset, mental state, and self-talk.
Well, I think, first of all, that is a process that, I think a lot of people think that just happens on race day, But race days, and depending on the venue, the course, wherever you are, the type of event, is it the biggest, you know, competition of your life or whatever? There can be so many different things going on that I think it's most important to think about it like you have a toolbox, and every time you're training, or, you know, outside of the sport, when you're working on, like, it doesn't have to be training on snow. It can be in the gym. It can be just working on mindfulness techniques, developing self-awareness. You're just putting more and more tools in your toolbox, that you never know maybe necessary how you're going to need to use them on the race day. And I'll give you an example. Like, so for us, I think another thing our team does really well is that we try to incorporate pressure situations into training fairly often. Whether that's the coaches making it a thing, like, okay, today, boys, first run in our Super G training today is race run. Like, there's a, I don't know, there's a chocolate bar on the line or something, that like, it literally doesn't have to be anything of value really, but it just kind of like, it gets the boys, you know, looking at each other in the start, like, I want that. Take it down. And sometimes that's from the coaches. Sometimes that's just between the guys, like me and one of the, you know, Jack, I think about in, preseason training this year, me and Jack Crawford, it was like the last run of the day. And we had been so close on the first interval of our training course every day. We like a few hundies apart every time. So like, that's not even the full course, but it was just like a little competitive thing that we kind of had between us. And on the last round, it's like, okay, let's see who can take that first split this time. Let's put something on the line. And just making it a little bit more fun like that, kind of practicing pressure situations. I think first of all, that just gives you a sense of maybe how you react in those situations. And then you can debrief and think about it later. Okay, this is how I felt in that situation. Maybe I should try this. Like, was I too hyped up? Did I feel too calm and I had a hard time getting myself going? I think it's important to try those situations, like expose yourself to that as much as you can, and then consciously debrief on it afterwards, to think about what you might need and what you might want to work on. I've also been, you know, we have a mental performance coach, so discuss a lot of this stuff, with her, and techniques, whether it's with your visualization or your sort of internal voice, the way you're talking to yourself ahead of of any pressure situation, and how that might affect you. But also, I've also gotten a lot more into learning techniques, like with my breath, for example, if I might need to bring myself up or bring myself down a little bit before the start, something like that, that I can focus on, that not only does it have a physiological effect in your body, but, you know, taking a second, like the last 2 minutes, let's say, before I get in the start gate, to focus on something like that also quiets down the voices that are talking about whatever else. Like, you know, maybe I'm having a hard time. I can't stop running through this one section of the course in my mind that may be a little tricky or something like that. Or thinking about, oh, I need to ski this way. Like, this is what I've been working on technically. And like, I need to do that. And like, there's too much going on, right? You can't have a million things like that bouncing around in your head before you go down a downhill course. So it also can give you something like that to just, bring your focus back to one thing. And I really like, personally, when it's an internal thing like that, like a feeling in my body can kind of just bring me into the present moment a little bit better. So I think it's important to, be conscious of those things and the opportunities you have to work on those things, and just keep putting more and more tools in your toolbox. And then on the day, depending on the situation, thinking about, okay, what do I feel like I need right now, and which tool should I pull out for this? And I think it depends a lot. You know, I can tell you, like I said, how different venues feel like they just have a different intensity or vibe about them. You know, Lake Louise, for example, is our only home race of the season, and it's the season opener for us. So It's a course that we as Canadians have skied a lot of times because it's one of the very few ones we got to race on at the NORAM level and long before we got to World Cup. It's home soil, so a lot of it feels familiar, and it's a course that we're all pretty comfortable with. So there's not necessarily a lot of extra nerves that come with that. But I can tell you for sure every year, the element where the nerves come from is the fact that it's the first race of the season and it's on home soil. And you obviously want to perform on home soil. You got, that's one of the only races you got so many friends and family that are out there for, and you know, some of the volunteers and stuff like that, like you want to perform for everybody. So that's a very different type of internal pressure. Then you show up at the Bormio downhill end right after Christmas, end of December. That one is notorious for being the one of the most exhausting downhills on the circuit because it is turning the whole way. You don't really ever get a break where you're just kind of going straight, gliding in your tuck or something like that. It is quite dark for the majority of the course and icy as hell. They always inject the crap out of that hill, and it is icy and bumpy and dark the whole way. So it is just gnarly. And like, there's been some big crashes there. There's been like, it's intense. So that one is a whole different kind of intensity because you're actually more nervous for like your well-being. And so that's a little bit of a different type of adrenaline rush. And then, you know, Kitzbühel is very similar. It's a notoriously gnarly course. The first 30 seconds out of the gate, you're up to 100 kilometers per hour in like 4 seconds, and then you go off a 50 meter jump, and it's in your face right out of the gate. And it's like the Super Bowl in Austria. There's 50,000 fans waiting for you at the bottom. It's just the vibe around the whole event is massive. So not only do you feel like you have the adrenaline going and the nerves for just the intensity of the course, but then the scale of the whole event on top of that is just a whole other element. So I find, depending on where you are and depending on what type of race it is, you can feel completely different. Like I sometimes I'm just like a little bit nervous because of my internal pressure and that I really want to do well. Sometimes I'm nervous because I'm like, this course is really friggin' gnarly and I better make it down here in one piece. And you know, I'll share one experience I had with you this past season that was kind of new for me. When we showed up in Kitzbühel for the Hahnenkamm downhill, and this is, you know, even though it's a gnarly track, but it's also one that our group historically has been pretty good on. We've had success there, and we feel like it suits us pretty well. So we're always kind of excited for it that way. And we came off a not super great race weekend in Switzerland the weekend before. So we're rolling in there and we're thinking, okay, it's all good, boys. Like, this is our time to have some big results. Like, we know we like this place. We know we like this sort of gnarly track and the ice and bumps, and we're good on that stuff. And on the first race day, out of nowhere, I felt like sick to my stomach the whole morning. And I'm not the type of person, I know some people get those types of nerves. They feel it in their stomach, like every single race. I've never had that. And just this race, for some reason, I like didn't, you know, didn't feel like my breakfast was sitting well. Normally I'm like hungry in the morning, want to eat a huge breakfast. It felt like every time I had like a cough or something, I was going to like gag, and I'm like, what the hell is wrong with me? Like, am I going to puke right now or something? Like, sure, I'm nervous, but I've skied this course a million times. Like, why am I having this type of nerves now? And like, if it was my first time ever on that track, that'd be more understandable. But and that was just a moment where that kind of occurred to me, like, okay, this is a different experience. I haven't really had this type of reaction before. So what am I going to use in my toolkit? Like, I still got to do this course today. I can't be like, oh, I've never felt this before, I'm not ready to go. Like, I got to pull something out to get myself in the zone. So yeah, that's why that was a huge, I guess that really just proved my point this season with having to have a lot of tools in your toolkit and know when to pull them out.
So my question is, what's your most reliable tool in your toolkit that you go to the most, per se? Or you have a
I think
favorite or one that just really works well?
breathing has become a big one, because I feel like I've just learned a lot more in the last year or so about how well breathing can, you know, your mindset and your like your mental state can affect your breathing. We all know that, you know, you get nervous or you get thrown in some intense situation, like maybe your breathing quickens. But your breath also has an incredible power of working the opposite way. You can focus on your breathing and control that, and it will also that effect will pass on to your mental state and your physiology as well. So I that's definitely one I like to pull out when I just want to kind of come into myself a little bit more, be a little bit more present in the moment. Feel a sensation in my body, focus on something internal like that instead of thinking about all this external stuff that's out of my control. Actually, I would say a huge part of all the things I do are to try and focus, bring my focus back to the things that are in my control. Because there's so much in this sport, there's so many variables and things that are outside of your control. Like you might just say one day you have the run of your life, but you had a headwind in one section. Sorry, that's out of your control, but you can't beat yourself up about that or be worried about that going into it because that's out of your control. So, you know, something like breathing to kind of bring me into my body and into the present moment a little bit better, or just the I think the self-talk and the self-check-ins are a big part of it. Like if I'm having, you know, nerves before a race and making sure I take a moment to be like, okay, what am I nervous about? And what is it making me think? Okay, I'm nervous about this one part of the course that seems kind of tricky today, or seems like it's going to be extra rough or whatever. What am I saying to myself about that? Like, what is the internal talk been about? And is there just too much noise going on? Am I getting in my head about that? Do I need to just tone it back and say, okay, I've skied something like this before. Remember this race where it was similar? And I did it just fine. Like and try to just consciously shift that self-talk to something a little bit more trusting in myself and thinking about it in terms of the things that I can control, not like, oh, I need to get through this section this way, otherwise I'm going to be slow. But you know, I know I'm going to come in here and I'm still going to charge this section and be looking for speed because that's all I can really control. If I make a mistake, I make a mistake, but it's better to come in there and be charging and looking for speed instead of being all worried about doing it well and backing off, because then I'm going to be slow anyway. And what the hell's the point of that?
And like, just kind of go over what you're kind of saying, which just for people out there who want to make it to these levels and how important the stuff you're talking about, the mental side of stuff. But what I like, and I like to like bring up, is I like how you refer to it as your toolbox. And these are different tools for, you know, different situations that you might come across. And like you said, you never know when you're going to use them. But I like what you said, kind of when you were doing your training, like it's a little bit of trial and error, you know, when to use these, you know, one, this, you might use one tool, but it might not be as successful as maybe you thought it was. Let's try a different one. But I like what you were saying, like, okay, you use this tool. Now let's go back and reflect on it to see how it made me feel, what I liked about it, what I didn't like about it. I think that reflection process after you're done competing, practicing, whatever it may be, is very important in order to get the most benefit out of these tools when they're needed most, sort of speak. So I think people, you know, they kind of know about these tools, but they're not utilizing them or practicing utilizing them to their most capable ability. So I like how you kind of explain that and the importance value around these tools that you have when you're.
I would actually say that I should have mentioned that I think I think one of the biggest tools that I've also added in the last year or two has been that debrief component. I think that's something that is very underrated. So, you know, a lot of times people, I remember it when I was younger, people, coaches, whoever would say, you know, have a journal, yeah. Like write down how your race went. Just get in the habit of writing stuff down, whatever it is that you want to do. Just get in the habit of, like, anything is better than nothing. And I feel like for the longest time it was always like, yeah, okay, whatever. Yeah. I'm gonna write in my diary, like, no, that's not, I don't need to do that. But that is something I do consistently now, and I think it's actually been one of the most helpful tools. And I break it down, you know, I might, especially now that I sort of know the majority of the World Cup schedule and I know how it might be going into a certain week, I'll start off by writing sort of a race plan. Like, what can I maybe expect this week, and how do I want to go about it? And what's sort of my plan that I want to stick to, something I can go back to and, like, check in on. Okay, am I still staying focused on this, these couple things or whatever? And then the biggest thing I've added is making sure I go back after the weekend and debrief on how it went, and breaking down, okay, did I do these things that I wanted to? If so, did it work? Did it not work? Was it in my control? Was it not in my control? Like, maybe, you know, maybe I did everything and it was great, but you know, something with conditions or weather or whatever meant it was still not a great result. Whatever, that's still a success in my book, because I still did the things that I could control well. So I think that's hugely underrated, going back and debriefing on what you did, how it went, did you stick to your plan, did it work out, yeah, all that.
And I think, like, that I think helps with being consistent. Like you said, maybe there's some uncontrollables that you can control, but it doesn't mean it was a fail or it was a loss. It's just, that's the way it was. And mm-hmm. instead of getting worked up about, okay, like, let's take that as a win. Let's go on the next race. And, like, I think that's a big process of, I think, staying consistent, especially in your sport. Like you said, the controllables and uncontrollables are so evident from one extreme to the next, let's say, mm-hmm. that, you know, you got to take some of those uncontrollables on the chin, and hopefully that you're, the tools that you're pulling out and the trust you have in the process and your technique and your coaches, it all will shine in the moments it needs to shine when you're performing. Saying that, you know, like we said before, you're an Olympic athlete. Maybe talk a little bit about your experience at the 2021 Beijing Olympics. I know it was a little bit of a different year, but nonetheless, you are at the Olympic Games and you're competing. So maybe mm-hmm. just talk about a little bit about your experience inside your sport and also outside your sport, and the atmosphere and energy that went along with it.
Yeah, I thought it was a really cool experience, for a couple different reasons. First of all, you know, getting to China and getting to the Olympic Village, opening up the whole kit of Olympic gear and try, like, the whole, everything about it was just really exciting. First of all, you're like, okay, this is real, and this is a you know, taste of something you've been thinking about for a long time. And one thing that stood out to me was just sort of the spirit of it all. Like, it does feel different, being part of Team Canada, the Olympic team, versus, you know, Team Canada national ski team. And the reality is, a lot of people recognize that a lot more as well. Like, you wouldn't believe how many people sort of come out of the woodwork that you haven't talked to or seen in years, and they're like, oh my god, you're at the Olympics, like, that's amazing. And you're like, okay, well, I've been, like, slugging it out for a while, and, like, nobody really had any clue about what was going on. But yeah, just that sense of, like, there's a huge team spirit, and you feel that, and it's really cool. And also being in an Olympic Village with other athletes from other sports, has a really cool feeling to it as well, because I found it gave me just a better sense of perspective. You know, you're talking to other athletes about what's going on in their competition schedule and how their training went, and then going into their competition, how are they feeling and whatnot, or after their competition. You can build off their vibe. You can kind of learn from what's going on with them too. And you just get a look at something. You know, we bounce around in our ski racing bubble, and especially, I got to say, that was super exaggerated because of the pandemic. Like, we were really much bouncing around in our little bubble and closed off from so much of the world, that when we got there, even though it was like total crazy COVID protocols, it was the first time in a while where I felt like, you know, our world has expanded a little bit more, and we're talking to other athletes and what's going on in their lives. And that was really cool. So that felt like a big event and a big experience to me. And it's funny because I've had a lot of other athletes who were, who had previous games experience, or just ones who were at, because there's three villages in Beijing. And so ones that were at other villages, ours was the smallest village. First of all, there's only alpine, bobsled, luge, like just the sliding sports and the alpine sports. And so I'm there thinking it's this big cool experience, and everybody else is like, okay, first of all, dude, like, this is nothing compared to a non-COVID games. Like, they would have been next level, you know. Like, this is just a sliver of it. The second of all, like, there's only like three sports here. Like, the other villages are way bigger. Or think about a games where all the sports are in the same village. Like, that would blow your mind. And I'm like, holy crap, that would blow my mind. Like, this, I thought this was a big deal, you know? And this is, everyone's like, oh, this is actually not even nearly the same thing. So, in some ways felt like it was just a taste, and I would love to be there again and get more of the normal experience, let's say. But also there was definitely a bit of a journey with the mentality going through those games. Like, you know, we show up, we're super excited off the bat. Like I said, we actually had a sit down with our mental performance coach shortly after we got there, and just talked about these things. How are you guys feeling going into it? Like, where are you at right now? And the vibe for a lot of us on the team was, you know, it feels in a way like the pressure is off to an extent. Like, there was so much buildup to this. There was so much pressure and focus on making criteria and just getting there in the first place. Like, now that we're here, it's kind of like, oh, I can relax a little bit. Like, I don't have to worry about any of that anymore. I'm here, I've made it, and now it's just time to go and ski the best I can. Like, in a way, it felt like the pressure had come off for a bit. And then as we kind of crept towards the race days, and then on the race days, I found it quite interesting how that pressure, that internal pressure, really built back up. And it kind of snuck up on me in a sense, I would say. Like, I think what happens is, once you get closer to the actual moment, you start to realize, like, holy shit, this is something I really want personally. Like, I really want to do well here. Doesn't matter, you know, I've already made it. I can call myself an Olympian, whatever. There's like all the support in the world coming from back home, but it's still your moment where you personally want to perform so badly. And that kind of crept back in, and that was where sort of the race day nerves came from. And I had started for us with the downhill race. We had the downhill, then the super G, and then the combined. And I did not great in the downhill. Like, I can't even remember my placing. Maybe I was 22nd. I don't know, but it was not like, it was, you know, not terrible, not anywhere close to where I wanted to be. Yeah. And I thought, I got one more good chance in the super G. I just want to, my goal for this run is to just put it all on the line. 'Cause the last thing I want to do is leave the Olympics feeling like I didn't go for it in that moment. So that was my mindset going into it. I'm just going to charge. I want to leave it on the hill this run. And I push out of the gate. I'm hammering. Maybe five turns in, I go a little too straight over a roll and miss the next gate. And I'm like, are you freaking kidding me? Like, okay, so I left it all out there for five turns, like not even close to halfway down the course. So how do I even look back on that? Was that a success in some ways, or just a massive failure? I don't know. And what happened was, you know, I was never supposed to do the combined event because I haven't really skied slalom in a long time. There's a few other guys on my team who were a lot better slalom skiers when they're younger. And they've kept up with a little bit of training every now and then just to be prepared for events like that. And I hadn't skied slalom in 2 years, but now all of a sudden they decided we're going to put you in the downhill or in the combined, sorry. Mainly because of the downhill run. It was a downhill and a slalom run. And what happens is if you have a good result in the downhill and then you finish the slalom, you just have to make it down slalom, you actually get an individual downhill result as well. And I kind of needed that at that point in the season. So they decided we're going to put you in the combined. The focus is really just on the downhill. Like that's what you're there for. Get a downhill result. We'll worry about the slalom afterwards. And so I had just come off these couple crappy races. I was not that happy with myself. And going into this, you know, I got one more downhill run on this course. And I remember I was at the start gate and I was like, you know, this is my last run. This is probably the last time I'm ever going to stand in the start gate. This is my last run ever on this hill. I can't imagine I'm going to be back in Yangqing. Like, let's just go for it. Like, relax. Let's have some fun with this run. I just want to end on a good note and just, yeah, have something I can feel good about. And the funny thing was that the guy in front of me actually crashed, and there was a big stop start. So I'm next in the gate. I'm standing there. I'm in my spandex suit. It's freezing cold. I'm trying to like just stay warmed up in the hut, and we're on hold for like 15, 20 minutes. And my serviceman and my physio are there with me. And we're kind of, I think, like, honestly, great team effort in this respect. Like, my physio is telling me some jokes and we're kind of laughing at each other. The start official is also Canadian, actually. So he would like come back every now and then and like, chat. Oh yeah, you know, it looks like maybe we got 5-10 more minutes. And like, it was really nice to have him, actually. It felt a little bit more sort of familiar. But they did a great job of just kind of keeping me like relaxed, keeping the mood light. We're telling some jokes. And then they say, okay, you know, course is clear now. We're going to get going in a couple more minutes. And then sort of zone back in, do up the buckles. And I'm like, okay, this is it. Like, let's have some fun on this last run. And I ended up third on the run. And I was only, you know, a few tenths off the lead, and so much better in every way. You know, the way I skied, the result, of course. And yeah, just that, with that more relaxed attitude. So, suddenly then I find myself in medal position going into the slalom, and everybody's like, oh, how are you feeling? Are you like, you think you can take home a medal? And I'm like, actually, I haven't been on slalom skis in 2 years. Like, I don't know what the hell to expect here. So that was a whole other story, but, that was sort of the journey and the way it evolved through from the beginning to the end of the games, feeling like, oh, there's no pressure. And then there's all of a sudden this big pressure that creeps back in, and then trying to find a way to get back to like being more relaxed and just letting it flow and happen.
And like, that's what I love about these stories. Like, that's like, that's what one, that's 1 or 2 days of how your emotions went up and down. Like, obviously, like you said, when people watch the event, you know, they don't hear or feel any of this. So when someone can put that into perspective and be like, okay, like, this is just how hard it is to, you know, perform at this level And kind of like, well, it's funny, we now we're kind of making like a full circle here, because at the beginning we talked about people coming in to your life or periods of your life that are giving you an impact. And for your last race there, like these, your some of your physio coaches, this gentleman, the service guy, like they came in at a specific moment and just relaxed you, something so simple for that time. So it's funny, we're kind of making a full circle of the people that come in your life, whether it's a short period of time or long period of time, that play an impact on your career. In this case, you know, your last event, just, you know, keeping you calm, cool, collective, so to speak, is pretty cool. Just the way our talk has kind of come, kind of full circle. saying that, I want to just bring up one little thing. So I just want you to talk about just briefly, because I know it's important to you and your family. And I want to obviously, you know, let more people hear about it, is the stuff you do with ALS and supporting the cause there. Just briefly, if you want to just hint what you do and the exposure and all that kind of stuff you bring or bring
in. Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. So back in, I think it was, I can't remember, it was late 2012, or early 2013. My dad was diagnosed with ALS. And that was obviously just a huge shock to our whole family, and not just because of, you know, his our dad, but because, you know, he was a family doctor. He was, like I said, avid mountain biker, avid skier, health, just like the epitome of a healthy guy. And we're like, how is this possible that he's being diagnosed with something like this, like the one of the healthiest people we know? Like, it just doesn't make sense. It's not fair. But you know, when someone's diagnosed with ALS, the life expectancy is like 2 to 5 years max. So we're thinking right away, like, this could be really quick. We don't know what to expect. Luckily, my father's version of the disease is progressing very slowly, and he's still here over 10 years later. So we're incredibly lucky that way. But there was a big process there where our family had to digest that. And also for me and my brother to figure out sort of how that added element fit into racing and you know, continuing to perform. And it's interesting what that can sort of put you through, and in terms of like, does it make you feel more pressure, or, you know, I think it would be a different journey for everybody, so I can't say too much about that. But anyway, we that took a while to sort of process and digest. And after a few years, what ended up happening was my brother was trying to help my uncle get into shape, and they decided he was going to run the BMO half marathon in Vancouver. And they found out you can run for a charity, and they decided, well, we're going to raise money for ALS. And a bunch of groups raise money for ALS and do the run for them. But my brother's team ended up raising the most money out of any group that was running for ALS. And they got recognized for that. And it was like, it was just really cool to see him have an impact on that cause and raising some money and some awareness. And I thought about that for a while. I was like, I want to do something like that too. And I didn't really know how or what the best way to do that was going to be. And, two years ago, I had the idea of, you know, a lot of guys on the World Cup tour do custom helmet paint jobs. And I thought, you know, I've never done something like that. What if I used my helmet and did a custom paint job that was ALS themed somehow? And you know, the color of ALS is purple. It's pretty, like, I think it would be pretty noticeable coming down the hill with a bright purple helmet. And I was trying to think of how I could sort of make it something that, you know, people could kind of get more involved with and get behind. And I decided to come up with a competition where people can submit a helmet design that's ALS theme, you know, got to feature the color purple and stuff like that. And I'll pick a winner. My headgear sponsor, Haywood Securities, was they've been awesome in supporting this initiative and threw in $1,000 prize for the winning design. And I get that one painted on my helmet and I wear that for the whole season. So that was where the Helmet for Hope project was born. And there's also a fundraising component of it just on the webpage. We're just asking for donations and it was incredible. You know, the first year I had no idea whether something like this would get, maybe I get like a couple design submissions. I had no idea whether it would work at all. And I couldn't believe I had over 30 submissions in the first year and we had, over $18,000 raised, the first year. Now with both years combined, we're I think around $32,000 raised for ALSBC and Project Hope out at UBC. So yeah, it's been so well received and so much support has come out for that, and it's just been such a cool experience to go through and to wear that design on my helmet. And, you know, every time I look at it, it's represents so much more. So, yeah. And it's just a little extra thing I sort of carry around with me, when I'm on the hill and when I'm need to remind myself what I'm pushing for.
That's awesome. And like you said, just another tool in your toolbox to have a little reminder, mm-hmm. Sense of motivation. Yeah. I love hearing about the cause, And we'll definitely be following along with regards to your competing and as well as that. Before we kind of check off here, I just want to run you through a little quick little game. I'm just going to spit out a word and you're going to, whatever pops to your head, you just say, whether it's a word, a sentence, a phrase. Cass was going to go out seven or eight words. And whatever comes to mind, you just spit it out. Goal setting.
Necessary.
sport culture.
A lot of words come to mind there. I'd say key.
Yeah. Athletes' rights and voice.
Important.
mental health.
Crucial.
Olympian athlete.
Special.
social responsibility.
Powerful or meaningful.
Funding and sponsorship.
Difficult. It's always a challenge.
Last one here, mindset and the mental game.
Always positive.
I like it.
Power of positive thinking. That's
there you go.
That's my motto, my life motto.
Well, Brody, we're coming to an end here, and I appreciate you coming on board and taking the time to come and talk about a little bit your journey, your process, your mindset, giving advice and feedback to all that will be listening. And I look forward to seeing what is in store for you down the road.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Ryan. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.